Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick. Finishing tonight with our divisional matchup series, and we sit here comfortably again, as I say, on June 7th, prognosticating what's going to happen in these games that don't begin till week 7 in the division at all. The Steelers games are, which weeks are they? I know there's one that's late, week 13 or something, and I don't remember when the first Steelers game is, whether that's week 7 or that's a later game. But in either case, they won't happen for 5 or 6 months at a minimum, and we're still willing to look at what the rosters are now and try and see some of these matchup differences and try to focus maybe on some of the things that are different and maybe also some of the things that have worked in the past that might be the same. Joining me for tonight's discussion, Jason Smith. Jason, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing really well. It's weeks 13 and 18, and then we play them sandwiched in between the Browns the first time, so can't look past that matchup and that stretch, the very important stretch of the season for us.
Yeah, absolutely critical to have some success in that three-game stretch, that's for sure. Steelers, these teams know each other well, and yet there's a lot of changes, particularly on the offensive side of the ball.
Really is, and the biggest unknown to me is the Steelers offense out of all the units in the division. If you look at offense and defensive side, the Bengals, Browns, Steelers, and even the Ravens, the biggest unknown to me is the new offensive coordinator, Ben's health. There's a lot of unknowns on that side of the ball, the offense for the Steelers.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Matt Canada, completely new. It seems funny that we're saying this about Roethlisberger, who missed time, obviously, missed a lot of time 2 years ago and came back from a shoulder injury last year, did not look like he had all the strength at shoulder, elbow, and did not look like he had all the strength there. The Steelers guy who was on Alex Cazorez, it points to his knees as being an even bigger problem than the elbow this last season.
Yes, he said arthritic, which is, an alarm goes off when I hear that, because that's not getting any better. So you can reconstruct the arm and replace it and have it be as strong as it ever was. But arthritic knees, that's definitely going to be a concern. And then, you know, there was word coming out of there that they wanted Ben under center more, which makes the knees a tougher situation, obviously, if you have to drop back, turn your back to the line of scrimmage and get reset. So a lot of unknown on that side of the ball, and it'll be interesting to see how they change their offense, because I don't think what they did last year was very sustainable, and it eventually caught up to them.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. They went to it out of necessity against the Ravens, who were beating the crap out of them up front. And, you know, they went to a spread offense with, I said, I think, 10 personnel during the show with the Steelers guy. But it's not 10 personnel. It's 0-1 personnel, which means a tight end and 4 wide receivers. So they didn't even have a running back that they were playing in that second half coming back, for most of that second half comeback against the Ravens.
And I called it flag football. It was just the best way I could tell the kids to go out 5 yards and turn around and look for the quarterback. I mean, that's pretty much what they were doing. And it was a disappointing game to go to. I knew you were at that game, too. Mm-hmm. I was blessed enough to be there. And, it just felt like a game that we were in such control of, just running the ball. We ran 47 times for 268 yards against a team that's very good against the run. So when you're having that kind of success against a team that stops the run, it felt like we were in control of that game until we weren't, until they threw 3-yard passes.
Yeah, they definitely threw a lot of short passes, a lot of 5 to 7, 8 yard passes on those 2 scoring drives in the second half that brought them back. The Ravens were forced against the 4 receiver sets to come up with ways to stop that. They were a slot corner short. They had Terrell Bonds on the field. He had a 3 for 3 in completions allowed. It wasn't that much. It was 20 yards, but he also had a pass interference call, flag against him that was significant. So they certainly took what the Ravens gave them. The Ravens didn't give them a lot, but it was enough. And the other thing about that I didn't like about that game was the way the Steelers managed to keep the Ravens off the field and get their defense a little better rested with those long drives in the second half.
It's very true. And maybe we'll talk about later how how many snaps the big guys up front played for the Steelers, but that really helped them get rested. And all that success that we had, specifically in the first half, seemed to disappear, like you said, because we really didn't have the ball a lot. And it was truly an extension of the running game for the Steelers. They couldn't run the ball, so they went to the short passing game. The receivers actually caught the ball, I thought, that game. I'm not remembering a lot of drops.
Yeah, it's not a scary group of receivers, and obviously they had some key fumbles against the Ravens last year. Particularly, you know, Juju had his problems fumbling the big overtime fumble, I guess it was for him. But I believe they might have had two fumbles in that game that both went out of bounds in the game in Baltimore. I can't remember whether that's true or not. Maybe one by Humphrey or one by Humphrey, one by might have been Peters. But anyway, it was the kind of game that really kind of sticks with you and bothering. If the Ravens hadn't made the playoffs, that would be the kind of thing that would really bother you. And as it was, you know, the Ravens would have still been in the hunt to the very end to win the division if they'd won that ball game.
That's true. And we had our own fumble, I believe, when we were in the red zone down there, and the ball bounced their way. So it was a frustrating game. It really was. So one thing you know about the Steelers, no matter how good or bad or how inactive with due to COVID the team is, the game's going to be pretty close. It usually has been.
Yeah, they've had those. We always think of the games being close, and I think if Steelers fans have a little bit of a chip on their shoulder about some of the big blowout losses the Ravens have administered to them, but the Ravens have taken a few too over the years. The 37-0 loss in 1997, and the 38-7 blowout on Monday night in 2007. But then the Ravens have the 27-0 nine sack game at home, and they have the 35-7 game where all the Hall of Famers played at about the highest level they ever had in the same game. There's been some certainly on both sides, and more recently the Ravens have been a little more effective in this rivalry. But it's the Steelers, and that's the reason why we have this as the last show, even though they may not be the best team in the division other than the Ravens this year. You know, the Browns look like they could very well be the class of the division, but everybody really waits for that Steelers game as the biggest rivalry of the year.
And they make me nervous. I don't know. Maybe it's just history, maybe some mental scars there. But as far as how we match up against the other teams in the division, I was very confident against the Bengals, more confident than most against the Browns. But I look at the Steelers team as a team that could give us trouble. If they play their A game and we're not on our A game, I think that this is a team that we could struggle with for quarters at a time. So we're going to have to be on our game. We cannot take them lightly and under any circumstances.
This is a game maybe for advanced scouting to give the Ravens what they need. I mean, they usually advanced scout for four games, and with a new offensive coordinator and the Ravens not playing them until week 13 or week 12, week 13, whatever it is, late in the season, there'll be plenty of tape of what Matt Canada wants to do. It won't necessarily be against the Ravens defense. So, you know, they all teams try some different things, obviously based on the scheme that the other team presents them, but the Ravens really, because they are strong and weak in such extreme measures, they're built so extremely from a back to front method, I think other teams may, you know, look at that and say, you know what, we can't play our regular offense this week, we got to go to this.
And it's to the Ravens' advantage that we can attack on defense, literally attack, where other teams react. We could very well put together a game plan that the Steelers hadn't seen up until we play them in week 13. And that's to our advantage. You know, you mentioned I'm even interested in the Steelers preseason games. Like, I'm sure I'll watch at least one, maybe where if they play their starters more, or even if they don't, just to try to get some clues on how this offense is going to look. Because Matt Canada has been in the game. I mean, I made a note, and I don't know if Wikipedia is always correct, but it said he got a job while he was a sophomore in college with the team. So he was 20 years old coaching for Indiana. Maybe he was just the water boy or whatever, but he stepped right in as a graduate as soon as he graduated, a graduate assistant. And that was way back in 94, I think. I don't have the year. Yes, he started officially coaching in 94. So he's still kind of a young man, but he's been in the game since 1992. And he's coached at all Power Five major colleges and just came to the Steelers last year. So if you look at his offenses, I took a look at when he was at Clemson or when he played Clemson against Pitt. There was also a game when he was at LSU, and he also coached at Maryland. And those offenses all looked a little different. Like maybe it was above my pay grade to really break it down. But it seemed like he used the personnel that was there. And I really couldn't find too much of a common theme. I did see a lot of motion. He used a lot of motion, which is something I don't think the Steelers did against us last year. And it was a lot of under center play.
Right. It's interesting because it's something that when somebody can come in and impose their offensive system on the rest of the league, as Greg Roman has the last couple of years with the correct personnel, that's very impressive. But on the other hand, and especially in his case where it's really different than the trends of the league overall, I think that's very impressive. But it's even more impressive probably to do what he did at major college programs, where he used whatever they had and created a scheme around those players and did it. And the great ones, they can always adapt to who they have.
So the Steelers have their strength is obviously their wide receiver group. They have a strong running back. I believe that it's one of the easiest positions to translate to the NFL to predict how players are going to do. And Najee Harris is going to do quite well in the NFL. But, of course, the running backs are dependent on what's in front of them. So that is a big question mark for the Steelers. They may want to run the ball, but can they run the ball with all the new pieces on the O-line, DeCastro being really the steadying force at right guard there?
Yeah, they don't have a lot of great run blocking talent there. DeCastro is older now too, isn't he? Hasn't been in the league about 10 years at this point.
I thought I saw 31 because I wanted to look that up myself.
Yeah, look it up. 2012 to 20, so this is his 10th year in the league. And let me just confirm what his age is right now.
Yeah, I want to say he played age 30 last year.
Oh, no. Okay, there we go. Yeah, he's 31 and a half right now. So he will not quit. His football age this year, which usually goes by the 12-31 age, will be 31. So he won't turn it until the playoffs. And, he hasn't had a he's maintained his Pro Bowl streak of six straight now. He hasn't been all pro since 2017. Probably still an okay player, not the player certainly that he once was.
No, I don't think so. And I think Steelers really did themselves a disservice by not slowly incorporating more players into that line, because it seemed like for, a handful of years, you knew who was going to be on that Steelers line, and they were all very good. But, you need to replenish, and I think the Steelers just kind of waited till the last minute. I think, quite frankly, they're doing that at quarterback, too. It would be nice to have someone there that where Ben didn't – they didn't have to pin all their hopes on Ben being healthy. And with their defense, for them, I would worry that we're good enough where we're not going to bottom out. We're not going to have a top 10 pick, a top 5 pick. So they're in a precarious position. I think they want to compete every year. But the running game is going to be very important to them because, like I said, that the quick passing game being an extension of the run seemed to run its course last year.
So big new additions on the team. Obviously, Pat Freiermuth, the tight end, is a guy that they probably think they can incorporate right away, at least at some level. They still have Eric Ebron around. Don't know if that might mean more 12 personnel looks or it might mean they continue to go with one tight end on a high percentage of plays.
Yeah, Freiermuth, I think, is a good addition for them. I kind of like that pick. I think I had it written down. It was a second-round pick, right?
Second-round pick, yes.
So, yeah, I didn't dislike that pick because I think Freiermuth was a do-it-all tight end who can help them in the passing game but also have them disguise some packages. You don't know whether he's going to line out, flex out, or whether he's going to be in line. He has the capability, I think, to do both. So the Ravens are going to have could have a tough time. And I noticed that Canada actually ran some shovel passes, some little motion with a shovel pass, and I was was thinking that would be Freiermuth's if they incorporated that, probably his job.
We took it like a jet toss kind of
like,
look.
Like what the Chiefs scored on us last year at the goal line, where they kind of put him in motion, snap while he's in motion, and they have all this going on, and it's just a shovel pass like somewhere around the center guard area.
Okay, but he moving towards the line of scrimmage as soon as the ball is snapped, and not crossing the quarterback after the ball is snapped and looking for the jet toss.
No, yes, not a jet toss, yes.
Okay.
But I noticed some of those shovel passes, and he's just a physical player. I think that he'll play well with Najee Harris. It seemed like they're making a statement that we want to get more physical. But it's a great philosophy, but like you said, their line are below average run defenders pretty much across the board, DeCastro being the steadying force there.
Right, we'll see. Okorafor, is the guy I would question whether he's going to be okay at left tackle. They're moving him it's a potential square peg round hole situation. We'll see how good that works out. Zach Banner going in at right tackle. I think he's more prototypical of that spot. When the Ravens played the Steelers, was it 2 years ago, I think now? It might have been 2019, or it might have been 2018. Or sorry, it might have been 2020. I forget which. Zach Banner was used as a sixth offensive lineman. They ran the ball very effectively when they put him in the game. I mean, a very high yards per carry. It might have been 6, 7, 8 yards per carry when he was in there. So I think he'll be okay at right tackle. I think the guy that I think is the biggest question mark of all is Okorafor moving over to left tackle.
Yeah, see, he was a right tackle last year. Definitely a tough switch. Not sure. I should have done my homework to see if he played left tackle in college. Most of these guys did.
Yeah,
yeah, most of them did. So I'm assuming it's not completely foreign to him. But yes, that left edge or their left side of their line, with him and Kevin Dotson, who played pretty well last year, but still pretty much an unproven player. That's where the Ravens can bring pressure. That's where Calais Campbell likes to lurk over there by the left guard. And then you'll have Oway and McPhee, of course, just extra physical rush end. So the pressure from that side and maybe making them strictly a right-handed rushing team should play into our favor.
Yeah, you certainly hope so. So let's talk a little bit of Najee Harris here, because the Steelers' run game, maligned by their own fans, obviously. Connor is no longer there, but they still have Harris now as the number one back. I suspect he's going to get A-list snap count numbers.
Yes.
You know, they're really going to expect him as a first round pick. They're going to really expect him to carry a 60% burden or so. But they have Benny Snell and McFarland behind him. So they have guys who, with a little bit of NFL experience at least, who could still take a significant number of carries. I want to see how many Snell played last year.
I actually think, while you're looking that up, I actually think Najee Harris is going to get the Le'Veon Bell treatment. I mean, I could see mm-hmm. him have a 300 carry season. Them saying, "Hey, we picked this guy the first round. We're going to use him. We want him to win Offensive Rookie of the Year. He's built he's built for it. He can be a third down back. He has nice hands to catch out of the backfield." So I think that they're really, really going to really run the tires off of Najee Harris, if I had to take a guess.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think in today's NFL, there's really no reason not to do that with a running back that you pick in any round, honestly, but certainly in the first round. If you can expend all that draft capital, get what you can out of that player in the first 4 years. Probably don't take the fifth year option, but you could do it, and then let him walk. It's the only position that I would really say letting a player graduate seems to be optimal.
Yes, I mean, there are some exceptions, like with Gus, who has low wear and tear, and you give him a nice little extension. But for the most part, that does seem like the plan. And that's one of the reasons that, teams stay away from running backs in the first round. I mean, I know us as Ravens fans, we were happy when your pod when we finally saw Harris come off the board. Yes. I do like the philosophy of Pittsburgh as far as just from the identity standpoint, because they had strayed so far away from the run to where it was like it just was less than an afterthought. They were going to pass the ball. They were going to throw the ball. And you have a quarterback that's had to get the ball rid of the ball fast faster than any quarterback in the NFL last year. It really limited the offense. They need to get something out of this running game if they're going to be a playoff contender.
Yeah, absolutely. They do. And the guys there were not doing it. Snell played 26% of the snaps last year, by the way. He had 111 carries, by the way. That's a higher number than I would have guessed. That's not an insignificant number by any stretch.
Me too.
3.3 yards per attempt. And here's where it's even worse. And it's only 14 targets, but 4.4 yards per target as a receiving threat. So it's not a guy. He didn't provide them much last year as either a runner or receiver. And I know a lot of people are going to blame the offensive line, but that's very little production as a receiver as well.
Those receiving numbers sound like desperation dump offs to me, yep. and not screen passes. It's impossible. You can scheme running back to flank outside and beat an outside linebacker to the edge, and at least get 3 or 4 yards, even if it's a good linebacker. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's surprising that he had 100 and whatever it was carries. I didn't really see that from him. But Connor, I mean, I guess they knew what they had with Connor and tried to preserve him because he wasn't the most durable player either.
There you go. You know, Najee Harris came out rated as, I forget exactly where he was, might have been between 10 and 15 among all NFL running backs in a recent PFF article by Sam Monson. And, you know, we went over that a little bit on another show, but how do you feel about that as a relatively predictable projection to the NFL level?
14th? I just remember the
Dobbins. I'll look it up right now.
I remember the Dobbins being 26th on his list and that causing the uproar, and rightly so. I mean, it's just one man's opinion, so it's not their stat related, but still. Najee Harris, I could safely put him in the top 20. I'd have to really look and comb through, but it's not like a receiver, a safety, or a linebacker where you really, the projection is tough. I think running backs, for the most part, are the easiest to project. They can have year one success. If the scheme is anything like what he's used to in college, I'm not sure how that's going to match up. That should help. But again, all this is dependent. The success of it is dependent on the line. Like, I'll trust Najee Harris to get that extra yard or two that another back won't get. But where is he being met? Is he being met behind the line of scrimmage, or are they blocking it for 3 or 4 yards? But overall, to have a physical back, it would be nice for them if he can just keep the offense on schedule. Like, he doesn't have to break. If he can just turn a 2-yard run into a 5-yard run, or a yard for no gain into a 3-yard run, that would be what they would benefit most from Harris.
Well, what you're talking about there is exactly what the Ravens excel at. And if Harris had the Ravens scheme, not necessarily even the line, although I think the Ravens line is much improved this year. If he had the Ravens scheme of getting runners to level 2-4 first contact, and
right,
the success they have doing that, you know, he's going to be much better at yards after contact when that first contact comes in level 2. And for those who don't know, we'll just go through this real quickly. But players on the defensive line, first of all, they rarely miss tackles. But second of all, they slow people down like nobody's business. And you're in the middle, and they give second hit opportunities for a lot of players, which helps their missed tackle rates not look as bad. Linebackers, that's where you earn your money, is on your missed tackle rate. The Ravens, unfortunately, had pretty high missed tackle rates from Borden Queen this last year. But most, you know, the good NFL linebackers are still in the 9 to 13%, maybe not quite that high, 9 to 12% range of missed tackles. It still very common. And the best ones are better than that, but I'm going to say, like, a good set would be in that middle. Well, Najee Harris is going to increase that percentage of missed tackles. And then if you look at the third group, the safeties, it's not infrequent to see people in the high teens and low 20s there.
Sure, it's a tougher tackle, you know, open space. I guess the further away you get from the line of scrimmage, so that should make sense to everybody. But you know, the one reason I keep harping on the Steelers offensive line is if you go to the other side of that with the veterans that we have, I mean, it doesn't get more technically sound than Derek Wolfe and Calais Campbell. Mm-hmm. They know what they're doing. You're talking about stacking, shedding, pretty much extending their arms, locking out, looking where the running back's going. I mean, there were so many instances last year where they were basically using the offensive lineman as a shield. The running back's looking at that hole. Let me mm-hmm. throw him over here. Let me throw him over this way. So with an inexperienced, maybe not so talented line is the best way to say it. That's the kind of line that if we can keep our defensive line healthy, we're going to give them a lot of problems up front. Again, we're looking at a matchup way late in the season and, of course, the Week 18 game of the season. So it's hard to say. But if we have our vets in there, we're going to give them a hard time.
Yeah, actually, with a college player, this is, I think, a really valid point you just make, is that there's a good chance Najee Harris isn't even playing one of those two games or both.
Right.
You know, running backs get hurt. It happens all the time. And you know, once a player typically gets hurt, particularly running back, they have a tendency not to be back for the rest of the season. Maybe this is something that, you know, the Steelers and their roster, they can hold a player around for a few weeks. The deeper the roster, the less you're able to do that. Of course, the NFL is supposed to be coming back. I've not heard anything official yet about them coming back with 3-week IR this year.
Right. No, I thought it was official, but okay, you would know better than me. But it makes sense to me that anything that makes the game better, a better game, I love that. But you're mentioning the injuries, and I mean, these guys play through being banged up too. Like Najee Harris sure. doesn't even have to be out. He can be active and, you know, playing through a calf strain or a hamstring. And you're talking about how long that rookie year is and the rookie wall mm-hmm. where they go through all this prep and go through the draft and they're the first ones in there for rookie OTAs. And it's just a long, long process. So, and then if like I suspect they're going to use them and ride them as much as they can, by week 13 and 18, there's a pretty good chance he's going to be tested physically big time this year.
Right. And I had it wrong, by the way. Sam Monson had him at number 20. I didn't want to bang him around too much, but J.K. Dobbins at number 26. So he's projecting. Yeah. I don't know if this is for fantasy or if it's for value or for
quality.
Yeah, for clicks. It's
for
certainly
clicks.
For clicks.
Because there's no way if there was a real-life football draft that Sam is going to take J.K. 26.
Meaning of the running backs, just
we all get an NFL team and we, you know, pick a lottery and I don't think JK is going to be the 26th running back listed on his list. But then again, they don't pick running back, so maybe he would get the 32nd running back. So
right,
just a little PFF joke there. Sorry about that.
Yes, we know it is. If you don't play corner, you don't play wide receiver, you don't play quarterback, you're not worth anything.
Right.
Good stuff there on the offense. Let's move over to the defensive side of the ball because I think there's the Steelers, while extremely talented on the front seven, their depth at inside linebacker to me is something of a it's almost a curse to be there because they're so deep at inside linebacker that they're going to be tempted, I think, to keep those guys on the field for three downs when they should be playing dime. And they still have a lot of the same very serious questions at cornerback in terms of the quality of their guys there.
Yeah, this is where the tone changes in my voice because this is what concerns me. And I'm kind of glad that we get this team late in the year. Because I think where we need to attack is on the outside of their attack their cornerbacks on the outside. And that's something that we weren't able to do last year. And I think with the additions of Bateman and Watkins, it's something that we can do this year. But, it you know, sometimes that kind of thing takes time to incorporate, especially when you have a rookie Bateman that you may be relying on. So, yes, a very good defensive team, I think, still. That's an interesting point about their inside linebacker depth because it is a strength of theirs, I think, with Devin Bush, Vince Williams, and then Spillane played. I thought he played really well last year when I saw him. I'm not sure how he graded out. But,
oh, yeah, the pick six against the Ravens, so it's kind of hard
yeah,
to
right.
that one.
Right,
I don't think he was that great overall. I think he did have some problems tackling, but, you know, he was a guy who is not certainly not a bad backup.
Yeah, not a bad backup. But if you look at it, they're solid up the middle, which is what you need. It's a great tried and true philosophy when you have Tuitt and Cam Hayward, and then you have Devin Bush on the second level, and then Minkah Fitzpatrick has been a great player that we've actually had some success on. But overall, they're very talented up the middle.
Yeah, it's a shame that Lamar had that huge game against Miami, because that really got the Steelers Minkah Fitzpatrick cheap.
Yeah.
Because it was one of the worst games an NFL cornerback's ever turned in. They moved him to safety, and, oh, well, he's great all of a sudden. That's a shame. But it was the back end has Joe Hayden starting, and I think he might be in the last year of his contract now. So I believe that was what it said. Justin Lane will be a right cornerback, and then the nickel is Cam Sutton still. Sutton wasn't terrible last year, but I still think that unit is clearly the weakest unit on the defense. And one of the things that I would ask is, do the Ravens have an opportunity here to do what they don't typically do with Lamar Jackson and create max protect opportunities that will isolate those corners?
Well, it's a great idea. I mean, that if there's any game to do it, I think it would be this. We have the personnel, of course, that we could do it. And then, of course, you know, T.J. Watt is their main weapon. So you want to protect against him, wrecking your game anyway. So, yes, if we can match protect, and although Lamar might want, or the offense may want to, in general, spread things out, let Lamar create and attack with the short passing game, that would be a very interesting idea, because Fitzpatrick can't be everywhere at once.
Right.
So, you know, if you find out where he's shaded, maybe look that way first and go isolate and go to the other side. That would be an excellent game plan, Ken. Maybe you can fill in for the OC that week.
Yeah.
Sit on the meetings.
Let's not do that. One of the things the Steelers have done extremely well, and this doesn't necessarily work with the isolating isolating corners and using your wide receivers well, is that they shift coverages very well. And they do it when they blitz off the slot. They do it when they can move a safety over to cover for an outside corner who then moves inside. So they've got lots of different little tricks they will play to switch coverage. And that led to two pick sixes on throws to James Prochet in the year. One was by Lamar, and the other by RG3.
Yeah, those little whip routes, or jerk routes, as I call them, that Prochet actually showed that he could run. It was one of his or two of his three targets ended up being interceptions. Very disappointing, but yes, I wonder how the loss of Mike Hilton. I think that's definitely worth bringing up. He played a lot of cornerback for them. He's in Cincinnati, and what you're talking about definitely you need to be able to communicate to do that well. You have to have a good feel for each other, and I feel like Mike Hilton was an important part of what you were talking about, them shifting coverages. It's just very versatile player and a good tackler. Sorry, that's all.
No, I think you're on the money there. I just want to talk a little bit, because I always do, about the possibility of playing dime on this team, and they don't have a lot of experience there. Now, here's the thing about really finding your dime back. It's not that hard. Every team has guys that can do this job that come to camp. It's just a matter of committing to the thing and deciding one of your linebackers not going to be on the field. And not to get on a soapbox every freaking time we have an episode, but when you pay two inside linebackers, do so at your own freaking peril, is all I've got to say, because you're really committing to a lot of three down inside linebacker play. I don't think that's the optimal use of your inside linebackers. I know it's not the optimal use of cap in the NFL these days.
Definitely not. And I look at Antoine Brooks, the player from Maryland, who has some free safety ability, I think. I mean, that's a very, very debatable whether a player is a true free safety or not, because there's not very many free safeties. But Antoine Brooks, I believe, can offer them flexibility. And then he was a rookie last year with the whole mess 2020 was. So he is a player that I would look at to maybe allow Minkah to match up, not be a cornerback, but maybe Minkah can match up on some bigger slots or some slots that they feel that he can handle. And then you have Terrell Edmonds, of course, who is definitely a box safety. So maybe Brooks will be a player that will allow them
split
to play
the
more
field on the back end.
Right. Yeah. Maybe he can offer them flexibility.
Yeah, and I think that would be. I don't think they need flexibility. I think they need him to play half of the back end.
Okay, okay.
It's really just that simple. If they want to play, you know, cover two, he's their guy. If they want to play, you know, a more traditional strong safety, free safety, and only use two, then they've got a way to do that as well. But I would agree. Antoine Brooks lost a lot of his opportunity last year with what happened, obviously, and we still don't know who he is. He's a sixth round draft pick. That's right in the sweet spot of that Ozzie Newsome would always find these additional safeties who would allow them to play good dime defense. You know, over the years there have been so many of them, but you know, it was the right price if he can help them on these highly leveraged downs, and we certainly as Ravens fans hope that's not going to happen.
Right. I mean, it goes right to what you were talking about, how you say, you know, instead of spending on linebackers, you can get a guy like Brooks in the sixth round. And yes, I was referring more to a, you know, a cover two. Let him take his half of the field. You know, I think that there's a good possibility that they could do that against certain teams. The Ravens have to make themselves one of those teams, though. They have to earn that right to be a team to say, hey, you know, we need to play dime defense because they're killing us in the pass game, and we're going to have to rely on our big guys to stop their run out of, you know, 11 personnel and whatnot, if they can sneak dime on the field in those situations instead of just playing nickel. So, yeah.
That's like when you're talking about that, let's just be clear.
Sure.
That wouldn't be a first and 10 situation, because the first and 10 situation, the Ravens would still have two inside linebackers on the field unless it's end of half or end of game with a lead. So it's one of those two situations. If they're on second and 10, second and 9, second and 8, that's where you can cheat into dime early. And that's where the Ravens have been very successful at finding those places where you can get additional dime snaps on. The best way to get dime snaps, though, beat the crap out of the other opponent in the first half and play the entire second half.
Yes. And the Steelers can do that on defense. But, you know, we're kind of spitballing with them in the dime, but it's kind of hard to... You know, on one hand, it's kind of hard to see them stray away from their linebackers too much. I mean, right. they love Vince Williams. They brought him back. I think that they trust Spillane. I think he earned their trust last year a little bit. So I could see them mixing and matching with Spillane and Vince Williams to have both of them on the bench in favor of defensive backs. You know, it just doesn't sound like a Tomlin team. So what we think they should do or probably could do doesn't mean that they'll play a lot of dime.
I don't see a huge difference between having Edmonds out there effectively as the weak side linebacker on a passing down with the blitz opportunities he would present versus Vince Williams. I mean, Vince Williams obviously has a little bit better chance to beat a running back. But if you're Terrell Edmonds, you run the same way off somebody else's butt to get free on an uncontested rush. And I would think that, you know, the additional pass coverage value you get there is why I always like a safety in that situation. Your third best safety is always a better coverage asset than your second best inside linebacker. There's almost no exceptions to that rule in the NFL.
And we scored on him. We went directly to Boykin on Vince Williams, which was just a great throw by Lamar last year in the end zone. And, you know, basically he made Boykin catch that ball. It was perfectly placed on him. But again, if you have a safety, like to your point, he's got to be better in coverage than a guy like Vince Williams, who's just a big, effective at what he does. And coverage isn't it, you know?
Yeah. And you know, it takes on those downs, it takes understanding of the rest of the field, and safeties grow up learning that. And linebackers, it's the last of their responsibilities that they learn. So it's you know, it's one of these things that you really just got to accept at some point that even if I have a great linebacker, we don't need to go into this every episode because you know, all of the cap things, all of the injury risk that goes with having these three down unicorns in there, I just don't buy it. I don't like it. And, you know, I think dime is the way to go. I did want to talk about one other thing. Do you have anything more to say on that this first and then I'll bring it up?
No, I guess where my counterpoint would be is I don't mind drafting them. I don't mind spending a pick on a player you think that you project to play all three downs at a linebacker. But as far as paying them, I'm out. I'm out on that. That's too much money.
And are you okay just having one, or are you going okay on draft capital on a second?
early on, I just won for sure. Okay. I mean, if you're talking fifth, sixth round, or I mean, I guess like I'm a big fan of Harrison, you know, so I didn't mind the pick because I love the player. But I would say that that would be more the definitely more the exception than the rule to me. I think you could find two down linebackers like you can find box safeties. You know, they're out there.
They're out there, and the Ravens have an incredible record of finding them through the UDFA process with, you know, Scott and McLean and Ellerby. And, you know, it's a lot of their really fine, high leverage inside linebacker downs, not high leverage, I don't want to say that, but a lot of their important inside linebacker play has come from undrafted players.
And Bart Scott, right?
Bart, did I not say Bart Scott?
You did not.
Oh,
The mad bag.
The biggest of them all.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, I did want to hit on one other thing before we cut up this episode. And this is something that the Steelers are not unique in, but they do it more than most other teams, is they really overwork their two monsters on the inside. Tua and Hayward play a ton of snaps. And we were just looking at this before the show, but this is interesting that Tua last year played 76% of the snaps, but he also missed a game. So it's really like you got to take away 6% of the snaps for missing one game. And then, so 94 is the denominator. Think of it that way. And he played 76% of the snaps. So he really played 76 over 94, puts it in the 80s. The Ravens haven't had guys on the interior defensive line who played in the 80s at all. They play a very strict rotational defensive line thing. They don't have guys who play a lot of consecutive snaps, and they don't have a lot of guys who play a lot of total snaps.
And I tell you what, that I love the fact that we don't stress our defensive linemen like that, because it's such a physical position, and you're talking about big guys. I mean, these are 300-pound guys that you're asking to play, like you said, about really what it comes down to. He's playing 80% plus of the snaps in every game that they're playing, 300-pound guys on the inside. Now, they're very, very effective, so it's tempting to play them every down, but this is a situation, like I suggested, on their offensive line where they really need to draft someone and work them in like the Ravens have with Matt Abike, and many players before them, where you give them their chunk, you give them their down or their matchup that you like, and you just give them a responsibility, and there's not much drop off because the Steelers, without Cam Hayward and Tuitt, all of a sudden you have Carlos Davis and Isaiah Buggs behind them. Right. They have Tyson, I won't mess up his last name.
Alulu.
I think it's Alulu or something. But they have some big guys, but not much depth. So they're very top heavy on that defensive line.
Yeah, I agree. You know, Cam Hayward, by the way, almost the same exact stats, 78% of the snaps in 15 games. So he played an even higher percentage. Works out to about 83% of the snaps that he played when you take out the one game out of the denominator. It's just really strange to me that they really did not think they had an alternative to doing that. They have, I mean, we look at where the Ravens season went awry in the middle of the year, where it almost got lost in the Tennessee game, the New England game. It was that defensive line asking a huge number of snaps out of Ellis that really was the killer. And, you know, you saw in those games how he got progressively ineffective as the game went on.
Yes.
I don't blame him at all for that. In fact, I think he can still help the Ravens as a rotational nose tackle. I just think, he should be limited to 25 or 30% of the snaps maybe, and not play 85% of the snaps like he did in those games. He was forced to play almost every single snap after, I think it was Campbell was injured in one game and Williams in the other.
Right. No matter how good a shape you are, you're talking about, okay, we're playing the Ravens in week 13. We've been playing 70-80% of the snaps every game. We're getting double teamed. We're getting pushed around. We're reaching for running backs while we're getting pancaked doing so. I mean, it's a physical position. Like, you have to sacrifice your body to play on the defensive line, almost more than any other position, because even these linebackers, they can prepare for the collisions, and the safeties, they can prepare for the collisions they take. These defensive linemen are getting rolled up on, or they're reaching, trying to make a play, and then next thing you know, you you have a guy like Yanda driving you to the ground, or Ben Cleveland coming up. So the Steelers, that would be, if I was a Steelers fan, I would be very, very nervous, because Hayward and Tuitt are the backbone of this team, to go along with T.J. Watt, of course. And when you go to Isaiah Bugs, I mean, he played last year. Carlos Davis is a replacement level player, in my opinion. But they don't have much behind those two guys, and they're so important to their defense.
Yeah. By the way, very interesting. Chris Wormley, really, he's kind of a man without a position, honestly, because he's a better five tech than anything else. So it isn't really an ideal three tech, but the Ravens traded him to Pittsburgh for a fifth round pick. He ended up playing 14% of the snaps last year. It wasn't like he missed a ton of games. He was active for 13 games, but he only played 14% of the snaps. That's incredibly low. I was shocked by that number.
You know, that shocks me too. I hadn't seen that, because he's a guy with a veteran who you've seen Wormley play fairly well against. I mean, think about, Steelers versus Bengals, or Steelers versus Browns, where they know who the offensive lineman and the personnel. I mean, you can't tell me that you couldn't have Wormley take up some slack for your guys there, give them a nice little break, and, sure, there'll be a drop off in the play, but what about if it's 3rd and 10? That's not to its best down. Like, why is he on the field all the time? I don't understand it. But like I said, I'm lucky, where I feel lucky, that the Ravens don't do that. It seems like we're heavy into the rotation, whereas the Steelers and the Bengals, it seemed like they've relied on the same guys forever to plug up the middle.
Yeah, very, very, very true. Wormley, his last 2 years in Baltimore, 39 and 46% of snaps. So it wasn't like he hadn't already been battle tested with larger snap counts in Baltimore. He just, for whatever reason, the Steelers decided, we don't really want you as big a part of the rotation as you were there.
Yeah, thank you. Especially if you trade for a guy,
Yeah.
You would figure, you want them to get. It's a resource. They could have drafted a rotational player who played more than 14% of the snaps with a fifth round pick.
Yeah, I'd love to know who the Ravens actually took with that pick. But I
was thinking that.
Yeah, I don't know who that is.
I wonder if that's the Dalen Hayes, because that's who we took in the fifth round this year, or if that's if we traded it, moved it around, or.
I'm not. It would have been it might have been a 20 pick though, right? Because he played for the Steelers all of 20, so I would assume they got a fifth round pick in 20 and not a pick
in 20. Yeah, that's escaping me, because we didn't pick in the fifth round, I don't
think. Right, so we might have traded up or down or whatever to make that work, and then we kind of dilute it. It's too bad. Some of these picks, they like the one they acquired for Kari Vedvik, you really want to know who they picked with it. You don't want to know, well, first of all, we traded the pick, and then we got two other picks.
Right.
And then, oh, damn it, why? Why did you do that? We wanted.
Well, at least we have Hurst for Dobbins. At least we can figure that one out.
There you go. All right, man. Always a pleasure doing a show with you. Jason, tell me where folks can find your work.
Sure. It's Huddle It Up Films, and that's both on Twitter and YouTube. I could use the support on YouTube, trying to get to 1,000 subscribers so I can do more with my videos. So I'm going to plug the YouTube. But on Twitter, I try to stay active and just send some good vibes out there, and also some things that I'm noticing. And I love interacting with my football family. Football is family. I say that all the time. No matter where you come from, no matter how rich or poor, your religion, anything else, when we step on the field together, we're family. And I always felt that bond, and from a very young age, and it's part of what I love about the game. You can have a line with a guy that like Ben. Oh, I'm sorry. I was going to say, you can have Ben Cleveland, Alejandro Villanueva, Ronnie Stanley, Bradley Bozeman, all in the same line, and they would fight to the you-know-what for each other.
And that's the players, but I thought what you're getting at, which I would also completely agree with, is we have a lot of different backgrounds we come from in Baltimore, but we can all agree that we love the Ravens.
And that's right.
We can agree to disagree about all our different viewpoints about how the Ravens ought to be run.
It's a very uniting thing, like it should be. You know what I mean? And I can disagree and maybe get mad at Ken, because I think that those inside linebackers are really valuable, and I love those Dobbins pick, and to heck with your dime defense. But no, just kidding. Yeah, football is family. I love it. And, you can learn something that I believe in life. You can learn something from a homeless man or a rich man. It really doesn't matter. And the Ravens have a lot of good people who specialize in different areas, especially on Twitter. If you're not on Twitter, don't be afraid of social media. Sign up on Twitter like I did, as a man in his 40s signed up on Twitter. You can just see, you don't have to argue about politics. You can see your Ravens stuff and enjoy some really good insight from our Ravens guys out there. So I want to send love to Ken and to everybody else who makes it such a great community.
I really appreciate that. I don't know that I'm really holding my own weight in terms of doing that, but I do appreciate that. I want to make sure Jason gets a good supporting plug for his YouTube channel. He's got a good video out there of the times Lamar Jackson scrambled in 2020. So here's what I like about this kind of analysis. When Jason put that together, he had to clip the play out from the All-22. Some All-22 angle. I think you took the top view, right side?
Yes, because it was the passing game, so you could see all 22 guys.
Okay, well, okay. The top view is the one from the side, so you can see route depth really well. So you did great job doing that. But the other thing it is it puts all the similar plays together, so you can look at them and try and figure out what was similar about the way things broke down to cause the scramble, as opposed to a designed run, because you just picked out the ones you thought were scrambles. And in a lot of cases, it was a line breakdown. In other cases, it was Lamar just seeing, I think there's a better opportunity for a run than there is a pass here. In other times, it was really coverage that caused the thing after a long time to cut. But what's nice about it is he assembled all of these clips for you so you don't have to do it. And that's what good football analysis is about. It's just a lot of hard work in the trenches, basically going down and looking at all the plays of some type. Okay. Best way to start your own study, do some analysis of your own if you're passionate about some particular thing. I really respect what Jason did on that. And it's a great watch. It's only about 10 minutes, but it really takes you through Lamar's 2020 season, and you can see why, at least for these scramble plays, the Ravens might have wanted to rebuild the offensive line.
Yes, well, I thank you on that. And I also have one on Bradley Bozeman and his polling against the Giants. So I don't, you know, my videos, I label them highlights because I think people search up highlights. But they're more like coaching type breakdowns where you can see what you were talking about. Here's a common theme. Let's take a look at it. And you can draw your own conclusions because, you know, people know more than they think. And they notice things just like the experts do. So I think it's important to give our fans access to all that.
All right. Well, great stuff, Jason. Thanks for coming on the show again.
Thank you very much, Ken.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.